Before you start listening to this podcast, we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, which will give you full access to everything on our website, and we'll also throw in a free £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth, and we're recording this podcast from the Houses of Parliament. It's a big day for Brexit as the UK has published and unveiled its negotiating objectives for the talks. We've had Michael Gove this morning speaking in the chamber to set out exactly what they are going for here, and you can listen to him now.
As a sovereign, self-governing, independent nation, we will have the freedom to frame our own laws, control our own borders, lower all our taxes, set our own tariffs, determine our own trade relationships, and ensure that we follow the people's priorities on security, the economy, and democratic accountability. But this House, our European partners, and above all, the British people should be in no doubt. At the end of the transition period, on the 31st of December, the United Kingdom will fully recover its economic and political independence. We want the best possible trading relationship with the EU, but in pursuit of a deal, we will not trade away our sovereignty.
James, for those who haven't yet read the document that's also gone up, can you just let us know the main thrust of what the UK is looking for here?
So, I mean, the big news line this morning is the UK saying essentially, if these talks have not made, to use that old phrase, sufficient progress by June, they will basically walk out of them and start just planning for a WTO-based trading relationship. I mean, what you see is the EU say, we want a level playing field, we want the UK to carry on following EU rules on state aid, for example, and we want EU rules to be the reference point for all these discussions. The UK is saying, we're going to be a sovereign country after this, and therefore we cannot follow any EU laws or have any EU court sitting in judgment on what we are doing. So I think what this does is, as I say in the cover story this week, it sets up a early clash between the UK and the EU over the level playing field and governance. And I think you see here how the UK are going to try and handle things, which is basically, look, unless these talks move, it's going to be no deal. And you don't want no deal, because that's economically disruptive to both sides. But, you know, we've got more time before our next election than most of you guys do. So you need to start compromising.
Now, listening to Michael Gove's comments in the chamber, he was quite keen to play up to the EU side why actually they should be taking this seriously. So at one point he said that he hoped the EU would listen to the UK's offer for a Canada-style free trade deal, because ultimately it is only this which would allow the EU to benefit from the UK's dynamic economy. How serious do you think the UK is about actually walking away in June, as the document suggests, if the EU to say, actually, no, we're not interested, no matter how dynamic your economy is, we don't want to have a Canada-style trade deal?
So I think this is one of the problems, which is the last 3 years of negotiation have left the EU, for very understandable reasons, thinking that British tough talk is bluster. You know, we heard this stuff from the May government and they always folded, I think goes the theory. This government is a very different beast, and this government is even a different beast, I would say, than the first iteration of the Johnson government, because armed with this 80-seat parliamentary majority, it can, in terms of domestic legislature, it can do what it wants. So if it ends up saying we're going to walk away and trade with the EU on more trade organisation terms, this parliament isn't going to stop it. I think that the EU needs to realise that it's dealing with a very different government from, you know, not just the May government, but even the first bit of a Johnson government. And I think this is the question, is whether both sides realise, you know, in a way, paradoxically, if you think it would be a good thing for there to be a UK-EU trade deal, you should want these talks to blow up as quickly as possible, because both sides need to get this out of their system, need to realise that the other side is serious about the negotiating position, and then you can start looking for compromises. And I think there are quite a few compromises that are hiding in plain sight, but you can't see them unless there is a, you know, there is none so blind as those who will not see.
Where do you think this landing zone is then, James, for a potential Brexit deal once we've had the chair throwing, the bravado put to one side?
Yes, well, once doors have been slammed and voices raised, I mean, I think there is a fairly obvious landing zone of essentially non-regression. So the UK will say, we commit to maintaining our own high standards. You know, we are signatories to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. We've looked at legislated for net zero by 2050. Our labour standards are higher than what the EU minimum is. And the EU says, okay, but if we think you're not doing that, we reserve the right to impose tariffs and quotas. And I think that deal offers something to both sides. The UK, you know, sovereign, it's not having to follow EU rules. I think the biggest problem actually is state aid, because that is where it gets really tricky, because the UK has traditionally had very few state aid cases against it. I think some of the EU think that this, you know, desire to revive the North is, how is that going to be done? And so I think there is a kind of question on that stuff. But I think that, you know, what the EU would get from this deal is that it essentially would have a kind of a sword of Damocles in some ways, in that it could basically say to you, yeah, right, you've done this, so now we're going to impose tariffs and quotas.
So far from the Brussels side, since the publication of this document and Michael Gove's statement, we have had a tweet from Michel Barnier, which doesn't give much away. It just says that they are going to take in the position.
Not full of warmth, I don't think.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a necessarily positive endorsement, but I think there's always tends to be a sense, at least from my perspective, that what Brussels like to do is at least pretend they're looking at a position immediately after it happens, and then you'll have the more negative briefing against it slightly soon after. But let's talk about the reception of MPs to what the government is proposing. I was struck listening to the questions from Conservative MPs after Michael Gove's statement that it felt like a very different parliament from the one that came before. Now, maybe that seems like a statement of the obvious, but just in terms of the question, back when you had Theresa May and even Boris Johnson, but he had inherited not quite a working majority, you have a point when lots of Conservative MPs would raise concerns suggesting that you did need to have a close relationship with the EU. Today, you actually had the opposite. You had Conservative MPs popping up to say, can you assure me? But the assurance they were seeking was actually that the UK would have autonomy, that the UK wouldn't give too much to the EU. So, for example, on the financial industry or on the City of London. James, do you think that these MPs are committed to the point that even if things do get tricky further down the line, say the talks do break down in June, they are still going to be humming that tune? Or do you think some will get a bit nervous about potential friction?
I don't think they will, for two reasons. One is, I think, you know, there's a large chunk, as you said, of the Conservative Parliamentary Party that believes in divergence and thinks that even trading on WTO terms would be a kind of temporary hump that the UK economy would get over. And then I think the other thing is that lots of the people who are probably most worried about trading on WTO terms, one of the lessons they've taken from last autumn is that, you know, Boris Johnson's brinksmanship works, and that Boris Johnson ultimately wants a deal. So he'll go for a walk in some country's house hotel with European leaders, and a deal will emerge at the last possible moment. And so I think the combination of those two factors mean that the Conservative Parliamentary Party will not be causing the government trouble on this front.
Now, away from Brexit, there's another big decision that has emerged today, and that relates to Heathrow. It's a court ruling, but this time, James, it doesn't seem to be a court ruling that Number 10 want to have a fight about.
Yes, the courts have imposed themselves on a decision made by the sovereign parliament, and Number 10 is quite happy about it. So what essentially has happened is Sadiq Khan and a slew of London councils had appealed the Heathrow third runway decision on the grounds it didn't take into account the Paris Climate Change Agreement. The courts have decided in their favour, and tellingly the government have said they're not going to appeal. Now, what I think this reveals is,
as first revealed by your Sun column,
is Boris Johnson does not want to build a third runway at Heathrow. The Tories know that one of the things in the election taught them is, you know, there is an issue about trust in politicians in general. Boris Johnson has his own particular trust issues. But so far, most of the things are quite complicated. You know, to go back to Brexit for a second, you know, when Boris Johnson says there isn't going to be a border in the Irish Sea, or checks in the Irish Sea, is he right or wrong? It's very complicated, because what's the difference between a check and a control? And it's not something that concerns most voters. I mean, the problem with Heathrow for him is it's very simple. He said he would lie down in front of the bulldozers. If a bulldozer moves in to Heathrow, and he wants to be Prime Minister for 8 years or so. So if it was to get the go-ahead, it would happen on his watch. And he isn't lying down in front of it. There is a dramatisation of that whole trust question.
And you have a picture that people can just use as an attack.
Just a split screen just becomes an iconic moment. And for that reason, and I think, again, when he had purely inherited what the last government had been doing on Heathrow, it was different. It's very different for his government to actively be appealing court verdicts to try and get the third runway built. And so I think that this government will try and see the whole Heathrow project, third runway project, wither on the vine.
Do you think they will look to other airports for expansion at this point? Because a lot of people say if you are going to have this global Britain post-Brexit, it's not enough just to focus on connecting parts of the UK. You should be also suggesting that the UK is open for business to other parts of the world.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's worth remembering the HS2 statement. He basically made the point that Birmingham will be closer to London in some ways of calculating it under HS2 than Heathrow. It's going to be faster to get in some... It's a slightly... interesting maths. I still think, though, that what Boris Johnson would really think is, you know, he loves his big infrastructure projects, and a big airport somewhere with not three runways but four or five runways is still something he would like to do. But I think there is this court ruling showed, you know, there is a major challenge here, and the UK clearly needs a hub airport in economic terms, which is what putting an extra runway at Gatwick doesn't give you. But I think one of the things that this judgment is a reminder of is these climate change targets, if you are serious about them, they massively affect the decisions that the government can take. If you are going to do net zero by 2050, unless you are betting that the technology of planes evolves dramatically, it's very hard to see how a five runway airport would, for example, be compatible with those climate change targets. So I think we are in an interesting question here. And this is something I think that I suspect that the courts will keep pulling on, which is how serious is the government about that net zero by 2050? I think one of the things that voters haven't realised yet is how much of a change to their lives is going to come from this target if the government really is serious about meeting it.
Thank you, James, and thank you for listening. Do you join us again tomorrow? I suspect tomorrow we'll move on to the coronavirus and the government response so far.